Case number 13-281, American Meat Institute et al. Appellant, which is United States Department of Agriculture et al. The statute for the appellants is depending for the applicants.
Ms. Stetson, before we start, I just wanted to make clear for the purposes of the audience that we scheduled this argument on relatively short notice. As a result, two of the judges had conflicts, previous conflicts, that they could not alter. Judge Henderson is here in spirit. She is listening over the telephone, so she'll hear everything and she can ask questions if she wants. Judge Griffith will be taking these on recordings that we'll decide after he reads a transcript. Ms. Stetson.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Kate Stetson. I represent the appellants. The parties in this case have had a tendency to describe these issues in terms of what the Supreme Court has not said. For example, the appellants and the panel, in fact, have explained that the Supreme Court has never applied Zouderer outside of the context of deception. According to the government, the Supreme Court has never had the opportunity to apply Zouderer outside of the context of deception. Perhaps it would be more helpful to explain what the Supreme Court actually has said, starting with Zouderer. Zouderer held that a commercial speaker's First Amendment rights are adequately protected as long as disclosure requirements are reasonably related to the government's interest in preventing deception of consumers. That's Zouderer's holding. What the government is asking you to hold here is that my client's First Amendment rights are adequately protected as long as there's an interest in disclosure. We are asking this court to apply Zouderer according to its terms. The government is asking this court to extend Zouderer well beyond its terms. And the interesting thing is, this isn't the first time the government has asked for this. In its briefing in the Milovets case in 2009, one of the requests the government made was that the Supreme Court conclude that disclosure requirements in commercial advertising must bear a reasonable relationship to a valid state interest. That was the government's argument in 2009. The Supreme Court did not take the government up on that offer. Instead, it concluded in Milovets in 2010 that Central Hudson applied to instances of restrictions on non-misleading commercial speech, and Zouderer applied to instances of disclosure requirements imposed when there was otherwise misleading commercial speech. That is the line the Supreme Court has consistently drawn since Virginia Pharmacy Board to Bates to INRI RMJ, Ibanez, Central Hudson, Zouderer itself, and Milovets. And it is that line that establishes, if you go back and you look at all of those cases, that deception is different. There is something about the way the Supreme Court consistently describes deception. Start with Central Hudson, for example. What Central Hudson says is, if a communication is neither misleading nor related to unlawful activity, the government's power is more circumscribed. The state must assert a substantial interest to be achieved by restrictions on commercial speech. That's the Central Hudson standard.
Is your position that there is no difference between a direct restriction on commercial speech and a disclosure requirement in terms of the standard to be applied? No difference at all.
The answer, in short, Judge Garland, is yes. There's no difference.
And the Supreme Court in Riley. As recently as McCutcheon, the Supreme Court said that there was a difference with respect to the core political speech, that some things, disclosure requirements could be upheld even if a direct restriction on political speech couldn't be. The court said the same thing in Citizens United, said all the way back to Buckley. Why, if in a core area like political speech, disclosure requirements are viewed more leniently, would that not be the case in a area like commercial speech?
Well, there's a couple answers, I think, Chief Judge Garland. The first has to do with the nature of the commercial speech at issue. Commercial speech already gets a somewhat lesser standard of constitutional review. And what Justice Brennan said in his Riley decision, which was three terms after Zouderer, in which he concurred, what Justice Brennan said in Riley is that there is no difference of constitutional significance between compelled speech and compelled disclosures.
But there is for purposes of political speech, right?
There arguably is for purposes
Not
of
arguably,
political speech.
That's what the court said in McCutcheon, and that's what the court said in Citizens United, and repeatedly in political speech questions. I don't see why commercial speech should be treated different. Leave aside what that different level is. I understand your argument about that. But why shouldn't it be less when all that's required is a plain vanilla disclosure of fact?
Well, I think I have to push back at first on plain vanilla. This is not a plain vanilla disclosure.
I'm not going to assume for them. We'll talk about the specifics of your case. But assume it is, just facts.
Yeah. I think the answer is because this is already subject to lesser scrutiny to begin with. There's not some subterranean hierarchy in commercial speech where you look at, you know, the question of whether this is commercial speech and then whether it's a disclosure versus a prohibition and then whether it's a fact versus an opinion or a viewpoint. That's not the way this area works. That's exactly what Justice Brennan explained in Riley. So the idea that there is this
twice
secret...
cited Brennan's concurring opinions. His concurring opinions outer complains that the court is being too lenient about this. So I don't really think you can rely on a concurring opinion where he wants the court to be less lenient to represent the views of the court.
Oh, I'm not relying on the concurring opinion in Zouderer. I'm relying on his majority opinion in Riley.
You just called it the concurring opinion. I'm not sure.
I'm sorry. I explained that he concurred in Zouderer, and one of the things that he said in his concurrence in Zouderer in footnote one is this idea that there is some kind of distinction of constitutional significance between compelled speech and prohibited speech doesn't hold water with me. And 3 years later, when he wrote the majority opinion in Riley, that's exactly what he said. He said two things of importance here. Thing one is, he said there's no difference between compelled speech and prohibitions on speech. The First Amendment protects freedom of speech, and that protects both the freedom of speaking and not to speak.
What was the restraint in Riley?
The restraint in Riley had to do with door-to-door solicitation of professional fundraisers, I believe. Yes.
Right.
So, and the second thing that Justice Brennan said when he wrote Riley was there's also no distinction between compelled speech about facts and compelled speech about opinion. And that, if you look at the way the government is characterizing this argument, their argument depends, it depends on this idea that there is a lesser interest within the commercial speech context on the notion that because we are merely disclosing mere facts.
But I thought in Riley, in the court's opinion in Riley in footnote 9, the court specifically said, we're not talking about restrictions, we're not talking about compelled disclosures in the commercial speech context. Those are different and entitled to a lesser level of scrutiny, see Zouderer.
That is correct to a point. The problem with that footnote is, of course, in Riley itself, Justice Brennan concluded that strict scrutiny applied. So, of course, commercial speech generally, which is the point of footnote 9, is going to get subject to a lesser standard. Whether you call it Central Hudson, whether you call it Zouderer, or commercial speech is going to be subject to a lesser standard than that which was present in Riley. But the holding in Riley and the point in Riley is that there's no constitutional distinction between compulsion and prohibition and no constitutional distinction between facts and opinion. And that is the basis on which the government's argument turns. If you look at every single Supreme Court case, all the way back to Virginia Pharmacy Board, though, and particularly focusing on Central Hudson, there is this distinction about deception that becomes important. The quote that I read to you from Central Hudson earlier, if speech is neither misleading nor unlawful, it is subject to substantial interest review, intermediate scrutiny under Central Hudson. That is the standard of Central Hudson, and that's exactly what applies here.
And I think before the panel you acknowledged that under your theory, all the statutory labeling requirements would bite the dust. I think particularly of the Cool statute itself and similar ones that go back to 1890. And I take it you would still take that position.
No, I don't recall acknowledging that all of those statutory requirements would bite the dust.
I also approach it de novo.
Or be subject to Central Hudson review.
Would be subject to Central Hudson review. That's the point.
But that is an obligation of government affirmative presentation of evidence.
Of course. But that doesn't mean – I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, what does the affirmative evidence have to prove? In Zouderer itself, it was evident that being forced to produce the new information would correct the deception. If it is the case that Congress has an interest in getting additional information to consumers to enable them to choose one way or the other on foreign or domestic meat, isn't it clear that the mandate here necessarily accomplishes that?
I think, Judge Williams, if the question is, does Congress have an interest in enabling consumers to get more information, then yes, the mandate here accomplishes that. But the problem is, that's not a legitimate government interest.
And well, why is that? I mean, you draw a great distinction in your brief between the interest of consumers and the interest of the government. But doesn't the government, as we view government in a democracy, have an interest in advancing the interests of citizens? Not necessarily all citizens in every single act, but at least a significant bunch.
The problem is here you don't even have a significant bunch. You have both in the legislative history and to the extent that government tried at all through the agency to justify this particular requirement, what it said was that certain consumers may have an interest in knowing more about where their food comes from. That's not the government acting in its parents' patriae capacity to undertake consumer protection.
In Congress, the legislators were more firm about this than the agency was in the rulemaking. At least a number of senators pushing the bill spoke very emphatically about their belief their constituents wanted to know this and act upon it, both from the protectionist and the health point of view.
To the extent we're going to look at legislative history at all and to the statements of individual legislators in support of the bill, I would agree with you that there are statements in the legislative history that certain legislators thought that consumers would be interested in knowing where their meat came from. But imagine, in fact, try to imagine where the end point is to that particular inquiry. If I, for example, am interested in where the beef, what size farm the cow was raised on, was the farmer male or female, was the farmer African American or white, how far did the cow travel before it got to me? Every single one of
those. Those are potential extensions. But do you really think that they can't be distinguished from this?
I don't. They're not extensions at all. The same exact concern.
Take your last one. You think that a court that upholds the regulation here would necessarily approve the one which requires the producer to disclose the African-American percentage of its workforce?
If the legislative justification is that certain consumers might be interested in knowing, that's absolutely the same result.
But in the record here at JA 170, it's from the 2003 Federal Register from the first rulemaking. It says there is considerable research indicating that a majority of consumers have at least some interest in their food's origin, and a smaller but significant proportion of consumers that have a strong desire to know where their food was produced. So that's in the history of this regulation, that the agency knew that there was considerable research that a majority of consumers had at least some interest in origin. This isn't just, to Judge Williams's point, this isn't just something on behalf of some consumers, it's on behalf of a majority of consumers,
no,
right?
I think the interesting thing, Judge Wilkins, about that quote on JA 170 is that it's from a 2003 proposed rule that never made it into print because it was actually pulled back because of some objections to the fact that it purported to cover born, raised, and slaughtered designations. In this particular rule, all the government said was that certain consumers may have an interest in some inherent attributes of the meat that they purchase. They weren't even clear on what it was. So let me be very clear about this. Whether you conclude that Central Hudson applies to this or Zouderer applies to this, the one point on which we and the government come closest to agreeing is that you need to have some government interest, not just an interest in the air, not
so
just
I take
a
it, just,
potential
just to, there's two potential justifications going on here. One is that consumers don't, in fact, care, and there wasn't enough work done to determine that consumers do, in fact, care. And the other is that even if consumers care, that doesn't matter. I thought your argument was principally the latter one, that even if you had the best survey in the world that shows that 95% of consumers actually care about this information, that just doesn't matter. That isn't enough to justify the law. Well, am I wrong about that?
No, you're not wrong, but we actually point to the first as well. There is evidence in this rulemaking that there is no market failure associated with this particular information flow, which is to say...
Why does the rulemaking matter? There's a statute, right? The statute says country of origin labeling is required, right? That's what it says. Why does the agency have to do anything other than say our purpose is to effectuate the statute?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. The first is we brought a First Amendment point to the agency's attention during the rulemaking process that the agency didn't answer.
But you did tell us the last time that you think the statute here is unconstitutional. Do you still feel that way?
Yes. We've argued that in our complaint
right.
as well.
So this statute, which requires country of origin labeling, is unconstitutional. Right? All right. So you'll be happy to know that when I woke up this morning, I brushed my teeth and I shaved. My razor has the name of the country of origin. My toothpaste has the name of the country of origin. I put on my shirt, my suit, my shoes, because what happened last week, I took my raincoat, my umbrella. All of them have country of origin labeling. I got in my car. It has country of origin labeling, and not just the car, but the engine, every place where it came from more than two places, the place where it was most produced, the final assembly place, my computer has it, even my highlighter has it. Now, the reason they have it is what Judge Williams began with. The Tariff Act of 1930 required it, the Wool Products Act of 1940, the Fur Products Labeling Act of 1951, the Textile Fiber Products Identification Act of 1958, the Fair Packaging and Labeling Act of 1966, and the American Automobile Labeling Act of 1994. So my question, and none of them have any legislative history more than ours, and none of them have a statement of purpose other than the Packaging Act, which says an informed consumer is better for the economy. Is your position that each of these statutes, country of origin labeling requirement, is unconstitutional?
No.
How would you distinguish any of the others from the meat labeling requirement?
Because this meat labeling requirement is an order of magnitude different. This isn't country of origin labeling, despite its moniker. The way that the agency has interpreted this is passport labeling. This is point of processing labeling. There is no requirement.
I asked you last time, the plain vanilla requirement that the statute provides, the country of origin, would that be unconstitutional? You told me it would. Now, let me ask you again then. If all the statute required was that beef coming from Mexico had to state it came from Mexico, beef coming from Canada had to state it came from Canada, would that be unconstitutional?
I think the answer remains yes if the only justification the Congress has offered is the justification that it offered here.
So then how would you distinguish all of these other statutes?
Because there are, in those other statutes, tariff and counterfeiting requirements or concerns that aren't present here.
These are labels for the consumer. I don't understand how either the tariff or the counterfeiting applies to a label, pure labeling requirement, and why that's any different than the pure labeling requirement here. My pen just says what country it's made in. It doesn't say anything else. Why is that different than if my cow says what country it came from?
Because, again, I have to go back to the fact that the government has not articulated an interest in this particular information. I can't answer all of those other...
Isn't that true for the others as well? The government's interest here, according to the members of Congress who supported the bill, is one... We think it's important that Americans who want to support American agriculture be able to do that, and therefore they need to know if it's made in the United States or somewhere else. Second, we think Americans who believe that the American safety regulatory system is better than that in Mexico or in Canada or any other country should be able to make their decisions in that way. And third, when there's an outbreak of an agricultural kind of problem, like example given in the House was a melon problem, example given in the Senate was mad cow disease, that this disrupted the American market because people thought it included American agriculture and that the market would not have been disrupted had it been clear which ones were American. Now, if you reject all of those, I don't see how you can, how if we decide your way, we don't have to strike down at least a half a dozen statutes that have been on the books since the 1930s.
Chief Judge Garland, it's not just me rejecting those interests. It's the government. The government here has affirmatively disclaimed the idea that health and safety and protectionism are appropriate interests justifying this statute. That's one of the most remarkable things about this remarkable case, is that the government actually has not stepped up and explained, and I'd love to hear the government explain, what exactly its interest is in this particular disclosure.
Well, isn't it obviously a protectionist interest, and they're not asserting that vocally because it would be in direct violation of U.S. treaties?
That it would.
And so they have an interest to help American ranchers at the expense of Canadian and Mexican ranchers. That's pretty obvious. Can't we just take that as a given here?
Well,
Even though they don't want to articulate it because they get in trouble with the international obligation.
They would be in hot water if they articulated
that.
That's
clearly the interest. So from our perspective, from a First Amendment perspective, can't we consider that? And why isn't that, I guess my broader question, why isn't we want to help Americans over Mexican ranchers and Canadian ranchers good enough in this context if anti-deception, if health, if safety are good enough? Why isn't that also good enough?
I think even in the more accommodating Zouderer context, for this court to adopt an interest that the government has affirmatively disclaimed would be a first or a second, because that's, of course, what the panel did. But in this particular context...
Suppose they articulated it, though. Suppose they said, we want to help American ranchers and we don't want to ban imports, but we want to discourage demand for imports so as to help American ranchers. Suppose they articulated that, just hypothetically. Why isn't that interest, we want to help American ranchers, good enough? Because I think that's what's going on.
I agree with you. That could be part of what's going on. Again, if we're gonna put any stock in legislative history, the legislative history is shot through with comments like that.
Right, from people in ranching states.
From people in the Midwestern states.
Right,
yes.
Exactly.
Yes, not from the Northwest or from the Southwest.
Correct.
But which is the reason that you don't look at legislative history, by the way.
Right.
But the point is, you know, even those comments now have been disclaimed by the government in its litigating position. And even under either Central Hudson or Zouderer, what the government has to show is some legitimate interest. And if the government, if this government...
My question was if they didn't disclaim it, but they came in here and said, we want to help American ranchers, hypothetically. And I understand you still preserve your argument here, but if hypothetically they said that, why isn't that good enough?
Understanding that they've disclaimed it, that would be perhaps closer to satisfying either Central Hudson or Zouderer. But, you know, even under a reading of Zouderer that goes beyond Zouderer itself, which is to prevent deception of consumers, the only cases that have gone outside of that context are from the First and Second Circuits, and they've done so only in the context of consumer protection and health and safety. So we're talking calorie counts, mercury-containing items, and things like that.
Following up on Judge Kavanaugh's question here, if they said it's purely protectionist, we want to do something which is to the benefit of the domestic industry, right? Mm-hmm. But they are nevertheless compelling another American industry to denigrate its product. So is there no First Amendment concern about that?
Well, I think that goes back to the beginning of the exchange that Chief Judge Garland and I had about whether this is purely factual or uncontroversial information, and it goes back to what Judge Kavanaugh and I were talking about. The statements about protectionism are plainly coming from Midwestern legislators. We're here representing, in great part, Northwestern and Southwestern ranchers and feedlots and packers and producers who are feeling the colossal impact of this particular regulation. There is nothing uncontroversial about this particular requirement. It does denigrate a product.
Now talk about things that were disclaimed. You didn't make an argument like that until a footnote in the reply brief, and only on the word slaughter. You never before made an argument about suggesting that there was anything denigrating about saying that the meat came from Mexico.
No, that's not quite accurate, Chief Judge Garland. We made an argument both in affidavits, both at Joint Appendix 555 and 576.
In your briefs to us in the panel, did you make that argument before the footnote about the word slaughter?
We didn't make the argument in the briefing to the panel, but it's certainly preserved in the record that we have an objection to the word slaughtered and harvested. The word harvested doesn't make sense for this particular product at all. So we're between a rock and a hard place when it comes to how we describe and, you know, to use Judge Brown's phrase, how we are forced to denigrate this particular product. You know, the answer to...
I'm sorry, are you saying that which aspect of it is denigration? The verb harvest or the source or the mention of a country other than the United States?
Both, Your Honor. The verb slaughtered, the verb harvested, and the fact that the source country is from other than the United States. If we go all the way back to Judge Kavanaugh's hypothetical, and you hypothesize that the reason for this is protectionist, that we want to favor meat that is born, raised, and slaughtered in the U.S., and we want to disfavor meat that is not born, raised, or slaughtered in the U.S., then that particular interest necessarily denigrates meat that is not born, raised, or slaughtered in the U.S. But again, this is a pure hypothetical. This is not something that the government has or can actually advance as its interest. And that, again, is one of the most remarkable things about this case. The government has been hard-pressed to articulate an interest all the way back to Joint Appendix 512. In this case.
Ms. Stetson, I just want to follow up on Judge Kavanaugh's question. Is there no space between the prohibition under our international trade obligations of the United States acting in a protectionist manner and the government facilitating consumers potentially expressing a preference that might be for domestic or for Canadian or for Mexican meat over others? For example, if a consumer is concerned that, as I think is the case, that the environmental standards in farming in one country are much better than the standards in another country, and the consumer believes that through market action that the consumer can, you know, express her preference, is that interest an illegitimate interest by the same token that the government under its trade obligations could not directly regulate on that ground?
I think, Your Honor, the question whether it's a purely illegitimate interest is one that starts shading into the government's trade obligations. The government does have some safe harbors within the trade laws if its trade regulation is in furtherance of a legitimate purpose, for example. But the problem here is what you've just described is a consumer wanting to make a market choice. And what the government has explained is that, including in this record, is that the market actually can facilitate that choice for the consumer entirely apart from the government forcing speech
to
be undertaken.
What if we disagree with you on the record on that? What if, in fact, the producers are not providing non-confusing, clear information that's uniform and adequate enough for the consumers to make those decisions? What I'm asking is just a very particular question, is whether it is illegitimate for the United States government to provide information or to require the provision of information that would facilitate individual consumers to make decisions on grounds that the government itself could not.
I think, Judge Pillard, under the First Amendment, it would be illegitimate, yes. The problem is that is not a substantial government interest in facilitating consumer curiosity.
You said it's not substantial, but that's quite different from whether it's legitimate. Do you think it would be a legitimate interest?
I don't think it's a legitimate interest, no. Understand the hierarchy within which we're working. If you all disagree with me that Central Hudson applies here because we're not talking about deceptive speech, if you all think we are in the Zouderer context, we still would prevail as long as you conclude that there has to be, as you should, that there has to be some legitimate government interest being put forward here, not just a mere interest in the air of a certain consumer, either a protectionist issue or a health and safety issue that the government has affirmatively disclaimed.
So even if Congress enacted a statute and the statute says in its legislative purposes that the purpose of this is to arm consumers with information with which they can make decisions based on the country of origin, because we know that all else being equal, consumers will want to protect United States manufacturers. That wouldn't be enough either.
No, it would not. That is more consumer curiosity. That under Amestoy that would fail, and for the litany of horribles that I relayed to Judge Williams, that would fail. There is absolutely no stopping point to that particular argument. And the government can find no stopping point to that particular argument. If consumers end up being interested, for example, in Judge Pillard's question, in the environmental consequences of where their meat comes from, how far does it come from? Does it come from a local farm or from far away? Does that get put on the label? Does the fact that this is a big business or a small business get put on the label? What were the cows medicated with? What were they fed?
The government wants no stopping point to that argument. So what's the practical real-world harm that comes from, in your view, from accepting the government's position? Arms consumers with more information. What's the real-world harm in that?
The real-world harm, I think, is that it starts drowning out the message that we want to give. And understand, it's not our burden to show the harm. It's the government's burden.
Right. You didn't make a drowning-out argument, did you? And wouldn't
not
it be
yet.
wouldn't it be difficult in this context? Because this, although you allude to a passport, and indeed more information is required than formally, but it's still not a huge amount of information. There's no suggestion that it's like the case in which a business card would be overfilled with data, right?
Well, I think what we're talking about is the failure of a stopping point to the argument.
That's to be sure not a clear line, but if ordinary descriptive labels and so forth would be terribly cluttered by the mandated message, then Zouderer says you can't go there.
There's a couple different answers. The first is this particular labeling requirement actually required retailers and packers to change all of their labels in order to accommodate this. So clutter is only part, I think, of the First Amendment argument.
Well, any new requirement is going to have that effect, right?
That's true. But if the government says, well, this is just you know, three more words. Tell me how many miles away this came from. This is just a few more words. Tell me big business or small business. This is just a couple more words. Tell me male or female farmer.
Well, Zouderer does include a burdensomeness limitation, but it seems you're far from that. In fact, could you clarify what is the First Amendment injury to your clients? As you mentioned that there are labeling requirements on retailers and packers, but you don't represent retailers and packers who are actually directly subject to this. Are you claiming third-party standing to assert their interests, or?
No, we actually, under sub E of the statute, we actually do have to speak, and I do represent packers who are
not publicly, though. You speak within the supply chain?
We speak within the supply chain, but we also have packers that label their own product for
retailers. Voluntarily, I understand. They're not the ultimate retailers.
Well, under compulsion of subsection E of the statute, we have to give the exact same information to the retailers.
But they're doing that as a convenience to the retailers because they think that's good business sense, but they're not actually retailers who are subject to it.
We do not represent the retailers who are subject to this, but we represent the packers and the producers who are subject to this, yes.
On the not controversial point, separate point, it seems to me that you're saying you can't look just at the explicit words, because the explicit words here are not controversial, but you have to look at the implicit message and how, I think, and that's a good point, but how are we supposed to figure out what the implicit message is of the explicit words?
I think that's actually the point as well, Judge Kavanaugh. For this court to have to divine whether something truly is purely factual and uncontroversial is a difficult task. That's not the kind of task the court normally has to do.
Yeah, I think, but Zouder, just to follow up on Judge Williams' comment, Zouder doesn't tell us how to do it. And the question is whether you look just at the, on the not controversial part, do you look just at the express words or do you look at the implicit message? And your point seems to be you have to look at the implicit message, which I take your point. I'm just trying to figure out, and this is a question for the government as well, how are we supposed to do that?
Well, I think it's difficult. It's not something that the court normally has to do. I think the signals that you have here that something is other than uncontroversial come from the presence of the parties in this case, as we've been discussing. There is a schism among the industry in this particular case over these regulations. That in itself should show you that it's controversial. This
isn't
just
all regulations. The word sugar is controversial. The word fat is controversial. And it's not the word itself, but if we accept your definition, which is to look at it in the context of society, then really everything could be deemed to be controversial. Whereas the pure fact that appears on a nutrition label, that's not controversial. It's fact.
No, I think the quantitative analysis that goes into a nutrition label is purely factual. But again, under Zouderer, something has to be both factual and uncontroversial, and even under an expansive, I'm sorry, Judge.
And to follow up on that and on Judge Kavanaugh's question, it seems to me that one difference here might be that what the court was saying in Zouderer is not as difficult because Zouderer occurs within a context. In fact, there has been affirmative speech and the disclosure is responding to something specific. And it seems to me that's a very different task for the court. At least that's how I would look at it in terms of whether that's the same as just a general label where you have to look at a broad spectrum of concerns.
I think that's right. And it's one of the aspects of Zouderer that is and renders certain aspects of that case pretty context specific. In that particular case, the disclosure that was required was necessary to correct what otherwise would have been misleading speech. So it was very narrowly tailored. It was targeted at speech that was already out in the air. But here, what you're talking about is a disclosure that is being slapped onto a label that doesn't have any particular endpoint to it, as we've been discussing. There is no limit to the government's argument. If you accept this argument that, as the government has argued before in Milovets, disclosure requirements in commercial advertising must bear a reasonable relationship to a valid state interest, there is no endpoint to that at all.
Isn't the endpoint that even under Zouderer, the government would still have to show it's not unduly burdensome and then also that it's justified? Isn't that the end point?
Under the government's formulation, that's not required. But there may be a point under Zouderer where unduly burdensome and unjustified come in. But if ever there were an unjustified disclosure, Judge Wilkins, it's where the government hasn't established an interest in the disclosure.
Under,
and that's this case.
Under Central Hudson, which you say should be the proper test, I want to just make sure your position is that I know your position, which is that health and safety disclosure requirements could constitute or do constitute a substantial government interest. There would be fit questions, but am I right that you acknowledge that those two interests qualify as substantial under Central Hudson?
Yes, you are correct.
Okay, can I ask one follow-up question on that, which is that if I think you told us that if Congress has a statutory finding that says we're arming consumers with this information because we want to enable them to prefer U.S. manufacturers, that's constitutionally illegitimate. It can never be sufficient to support the law. What if what they said was not just that, but that consumers want the information because they're just not sure about the health and safety implications of products that come from overseas, but they are sure about the United States. So it does have to do with health and safety, but it's not the government itself finding that there's a health and safety problem. It's the government acting on what it perceives to be consumer concerns about health and safety of products that come from elsewhere.
I thought, Judge Srinivasan, you would run right into Edenfield versus Fain if the government tried to make that kind of an argument, because you'd have to show that there's an actual harm to be remedied, not just a speculative harm. And for the government to say, well, some consumers might be concerned, and this actually, a couple legislators actually said this in the COOL legislation. People said, oh, those other countries, they're not so safe. The fact is you'd have to show a concrete and non-speculative harm in order to establish that particular harm
and
is one that needs solving.
And the concrete and non-speculative harm would mean that the consumer's current concerns, in fact, have to be empirically borne out. So Congress would have to say, we've actually examined the practices in other countries, and we've reached our own determination that the consumer's concerns are, in fact, borne out. It can't be that the concrete harm is that consumers actually do care whether their concerns are well-founded or not. Congress
That's
has
right.
to go behind that and investigate.
That's right.
That would apply to nutritional labeling, where there's considerable debate about whether cholesterol matters or doesn't matter, whether sugar matters or doesn't matter. Your position would be that unless Congress has established that these things matter, nutritional labeling would not be permissible. Is that right?
No, I don't think that's quite accurate. I think Congress can and has established that nutritional labeling matters, that it matters to the general health and safety of the populace. But what
there's
we're talking
debate,
about is one step
there
removed.
There is debate and controversy about whether cholesterol really matters with respect to heart disease or not. There's considerable debate about whether sugar really matters, whether high fructose corn syrup matters. All these things that would be on a label, we would hold a trial here to determine whether or not it's actually correct that these are health problems or not.
No, I don't think so, Chief Judge Garland.
Well, how would we resolve that?
I think to the point that Congress has made factual findings, or the legislature has made factual findings establishing that this is important to the health and safety of Americans, it would be difficult, I grant you, for somebody to come in and say, well, but cholesterol is really, that's just for some, you know, people with certain health risks. That's not the kind of ticky-tack, you know, foul that we're calling here. What we are calling here is the fact that the government has articulated precisely zero interest in maintaining this particular regulation. The two interests that the panel identified are both interests that the government has expressly disclaimed. It would be a remarkable thing for this court to apply Zouderer in those circumstances, given the government's express disclaiming of those interests.
Expressly disclaimed may be an overstatement of their position, but I'm sure that the government lawyer is prepared to answer that question. Are there any other questions from the panel?
I have one question. Ms. Stetson, I'm interested in why you have conceded that this is non-ideological. It may be because of our international trade agreements. It may be because the government doesn't rely on patriotism, but it seems to me that the Buy America intent that is partially underlying it is ideological.
Judge Henderson, I think there is an aspect to that, and if we are to take that hypothetical justification, which is one that the government, again, hasn't embraced. I think there is, you're right, an ideological component to that runs you, again, into the requirement under Zouderer that the information that is being forced to be conveyed is purely factual and uncontroversial. And it runs you into the problem that Judge Kavanaugh identified, which is when in these circumstances are we ever able to figure out whether something is purely factual and uncontroversial. I think that's quite right.
And it bumps you up to Central Hudson.
It does. It does. But understand, in response to Judge Pillard's question earlier, the fact that we're in Central Hudson doesn't mean that everybody gets a free pass. It just means that the government has to be put to its proof that there actually are concrete, non-speculative harms that need to be remedied. So the bottom line is, if Central Hudson applies, we should prevail. If Zouderer applies only to deception, we should prevail. If Zouderer applies only to consumer protection, health and safety, and deception, we should prevail. The only way we don't prevail is if this Court concludes that Zouderer applies to any interest, no matter how articulated, no matter how speculative.
Further questions?
Thank you.
We'll hear from the government.
May it please the Court. plaintiff's interest that's asserted in this litigation as relates to the First Amendment is an interest in not providing particular factual information about products that are going to be sold. That is precisely the interest that the Supreme Court described in Zouderer as a minimal interest. But plaintiff's theory is that based on that interest alone, that they are entitled to heightened First Amendment scrutiny of any commercial disclosure requirement that the government would choose to enact in order to provide more information to consumers so that consumers can make informed choices about the products that they eat in this case or that they use.
This is a First Amendment case. We usually don't start that way. We usually start by asking what's the government's interest in burdening the speaker or the speech.
Well,
just ask you to state as succinctly as you can, what is the government's interest?
The government's interest is in providing consumers with information that those consumers can use to make choices about the food that they will purchase and serve to their families or eat themselves. That's the government's interest. That's the WTO recognized that was the government's interest. It's a legitimate interest. Providing information to consumers is as
now, out of... What about a requirement that a Congress or a state could pass that required labeling, didn't say product of the United States, but said made by United States citizens?
Well, that might raise problems.
Why?
I think some of them might not be First Amendment problems. There might be legitimacy interests wholly apart from the
why?
First Amendment.
Why? Consumers, why? If consumers are interested in U.S. products, a lot of consumers, to pick up on Judge Pillard's question, might be interested in knowing whether it's made by U.S. citizens or not. What's different?
Well, if the government is picking up on biases against particular individuals that are protected.
Well, this is a bias against Mexican and Canadian ranchers, this statute, which is traditional protectionist impulse. But what's the difference when it's made by U.S. citizens? It seems like the exact same kind of potential consumer interest.
Well, to turn back to the First Amendment, because I was just talking about generally what the problems with that might be. In the First Amendment context, the question, as Your Honor pointed out, is what the burden is on First Amendment interest and what the government's justification is. Now, in this context, the plaintiffs are not arguing that they maybe started to do so from the podium today, but at least throughout the course of the case, they haven't been arguing about the content of the message. Their argument has been about how difficult it is to comply in terms of the costs to their processes and so on.
Their argument is that we're an autonomous person and the government can't tell me what to say except under certain conditions and uncertain interests that the government asserts consistent with Supreme Court precedent, health, safety, anti-deception are three that I think are recognized, but this is not within one of those three boxes. And so that's what I think is that's why this case is tough, is because we're going into a new box, potentially, at least as I see it, and maybe that's right, maybe that's wrong, but that's the issue.
Well, just to turn back to Zouderer itself, because that's the case that we're primarily analyzing here, it's simply not a proper reading of that case to describe it as a case about combating deception. If you just look through, there's only about four pages of the U.S. report starting on page 650 of Zouderer that are talking about disclosures. And it starts by saying the appellants, that was the regulated entity in that circumstance, want to say that we should treat this under the same standard that we treated the restrictions that were discussed earlier in the opinion. They say it should be a substantial interest, the government should have to show legitimate means. It in fact said a substantial interest either in deception or something other than deception. Then the next paragraph in Zouderer says, but they're overlooking the differences between disclosure requirements and restrictions on speech. And they say that that's the fundamental point that they were making in Zouderer. And then they go on to say, and this is not like the compelled speech cases. And they go through and they say they're not prescribing what is orthodox in politics and nationalism and religion. They're providing factual and uncontroversial information. And then they say,
it's disclosure requirements, though, related to deception. And if you go back to Virginia Pharmacy, as Ms. Stetson said, and you read Virginia Pharmacy, it said disclosure as necessary to prevent its being deceptive. If you look at Bates, it says disclosure, quote, so as to assure that the consumer is not misled. If you look at RMJ, disclosure is okay, might be appropriately required in order to dissipate the possibility of consumer confusion or deception. And then if you look post-Zouderit, Milovets and United Foods, again, at least as I read them, they tie Zouderit to deception. So what you said is true about Zouderit, but it also seems incomplete, particularly when you put it in the context of all the cases before and subsequent, which have tied it to deception. That doesn't mean you can't win. It just seems like Central Hudson would apply if it's not anti-deception.
Well, if you look at Milovets specifically, one of the cases Your Honor mentioned, mm-hmm. Milovets, there were two sentences of the required disclosure. One of them was a disclosure that what the advertiser did was help people to apply for bankruptcy under the bankruptcy code. That was one sentence. The deception that was at issue was that people were saying, we could help you get out of your debt, but they didn't tell people that they were going to do so by helping them file for bankruptcy as opposed to through some other means. So there was that sentence. Then in that case, there was also a challenge to the other sentence, which was, we are a debt relief agency. Now, a debt relief agency was a term that had never before, as far as anyone in the case was aware, had never before been used. It was defined in the very statute that compelled the disclosure. And it applied not to an agency of the federal government or a state government or a local government. It applied to individual attorneys who were helping people file for bankruptcy. And what they were saying was, we are now calling those people debt relief agencies, and we are requiring them to say on their advertisements, we are a debt relief agency. And in that case, the plaintiffs argued that it was impermissible to do that because it was going to confuse people, it wasn't necessary to combat deception. And the Supreme Court upheld the requirement under Zouderer, saying that it was providing pertinent information to consumers. Now, anything that we're talking about here.
It said it shares the essential features of the rule at issue in Zouderer, that's a quote, because it combats, quote, the problem of inherently misleading commercial advertisements.
Well, if you read the opinion together, the parts of the opinion together, then the incomplete commercial messages, which is another theme that's run through these cases, you can't justify we are a debt relief agency on the ground that consumers were being deceived about whether the entities in question were or were not debt relief agencies. So it needs to be at least broad enough, whether you call it incomplete messages or whether you just call it getting more information to consumers. It's clear that it needs to be broad enough. Now, just to go back to Zouderer, because there's another critical point about Zouderer. Zouderer made clear that the First Amendment interest on the side of the regulated entity was a concern. You know, they distinguished the compelled speech cases on the ground that it was factual and uncontroversial information. And then they said, we recognize that unjustified or unduly burdensome disclosure requirements might offend the First Amendment by chilling protected commercial speech. That was the interest that they were talking about on the side.
So suppose we're not dealing with a situation in which the compelled disclosure crowds out protected speech. Let's just assume that we're not in that land. Is your view that as long as there's a perception that consumers would like access to information, that it's constitutionally legitimate to compel a producer or manufacturer or seller to include that information?
If you're talking about commercial speech,
yes,
and
commercial.
A factual disclosure, and they're saying it doesn't affect the manufacturer's ability to get out his or her own message, then that doesn't strike us as a First Amendment problem. What Zouderer was talking about in that passage, and the plaintiffs haven't addressed this. In fact, in their supplemental brief on page 9, they have a block quote from Zouderer and the words that I emphasized by chilling protected commercial speech, which was the core reason that this would be problematic, are simply omitted from their block quote. This is a critical point of Zouderer, and plaintiffs in this case, as was pointed out earlier, have not argued that their own ability to get their message across has been compromised. If you look through the pleadings in this case, if you look through the appendix, if you look at their comments to the agency, which start on JA33, this portion of them, what they're talking about, the costs that they're talking about are production costs, costs of compliance, costs of, you know, we have to keep track of where our cattle are coming from, we have to, you know, mark them, we need to do all of these things. These aren't First Amendment interests. Now, they brought in the district court in this case an arbitrary and capricious challenge, and they said the agency's rule is arbitrary and capricious. The costs that are imposed on us are too large compared to the benefits that are going to be, you know, brought to consumers.
But in terms of what consumers want, do you care why the consumers want the information, or do you think that matters? So in other words, here you could say the consumers want the information because they want to prefer U.S. producers. You could say consumers want the information because they're not entirely certain about the health and safety implications of meat that comes in part from abroad. Or you could say consumers want the information for other reasons, more nefarious-sounding reasons, to give effect to biases and prejudices and things like that. Is it your perspective that it just doesn't matter? As long as there's a supposition that consumers want the information, then a manufacturer can be compelled to put the information on the label.
I mean, this case doesn't present a question of if a consumer's wanted the information for entirely nefarious reasons.
No, I know it doesn't present it, but or at least
I mean, I feel we're going to have to go that far.
In terms of how you view the First Amendment principles, do you think that matters, or is it your, and it may be that your perspective is that it just doesn't matter, that the First Amendment, that's not a First Amendment interest and it's something else. I'm just curious to know what your view is on that.
I mean, it's hard to do in the hypothetical. The reason that it might come in is that then the actual First Amendment interest might start to crop up on the other side if they say they're being asked to buy into these biases or nefarious purposes, as Your Honor.
You don't think that compelling speech is a First Amendment interest?
We're talking here, just to be clear, with the Supreme Court, the word the Supreme Court used was minimal, so I'll go back to that. But what we're talking about is commercial disclosures of factual information that do not affect the entity's ability to put forward their own message. Now, in Zatterer, the Supreme Court...
So your answer to Judge Brown's question is, yes, businesses do have a First Amendment speech interest against compelled disclosure, correct? It may be minimal, but it's an interest, correct?
Right, but it doesn't rise to the level of something that would be that would be constitutionally problematic.
I just wanted to get the yes clear because you were suggesting that they were outside, there was no First Amendment issue at all here.
Well, I mean, the question here is whether they have a First Amendment claim that can prevail. I'm not interested in saying that they, you know, in quibbling about, you know, whether it's...
Well, it's not quibbling. The Supreme Court, footnote 14 in Zouder, says the First Amendment interests implicated by disclosure requirements are substantially weaker. Doesn't say that they're non-existent. It's the
right.
Government's position that they're non-existent. If you're going to rely on Zouder, you've got to take the whole thing.
We're not saying it's non-existent. We're just, and I apologize if I was unclear. What I'm trying to get at here is simply what the government should need to show in order to overcome the interest. Now, the
opposing counsel says that you have disclaimed the interests expressed in the legislative history. So as I think I read the legislative history, and the panel did anyway, this was about government's interest in consumers being able to make choices about buying American products and about looking for and acting on their own beliefs about the safety regulatory considerations of American products or of Canadian products or Mexican products, depending on where an outbreak occurs. Are you disclaiming those interests? Has the government said that those are not the interests of the statute or not acceptable interests?
No, the way that you put it is exactly right. It's furthering consumers' ability to act on their own preferences in the respects you've mentioned and potentially others. And of course, we're not disclaiming those interests.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, I'm sorry.
You finished the answer.
Yes.
Is the government asserting an interest in helping American ranchers and hog growers?
The interests are in allowing consumers to do what the consumers want to do in terms of making choices.
So is that a no?
We're not directly trying to help American ranchers.
Are you no. Indirectly?
It might have that effect depending on consumer preferences.
Is that the government's asserted interest? I'll just state the question again. Is the government asserting an interest in helping American ranchers and hog growers?
As opposed to Canadian or Mexican, no, it is not.
Aren't we stepping around some WTO issue that we don't understand? Maybe we are. The legislative history says that both Mexico and Canada have country of origin labeling requirements, and that Canada requires the country of origin to be labeled, including on meat, and that, or maybe the other way around, Mexico does, and that Canada has it on prepared meat. Is this true? Do other countries all have these as well?
Other countries have requirements. I don't know the precise details of all of them. The point, the distinction that we've been talking about is a critical distinction in the WTO context about whether you're enacting a measure as a protectionist measure or you're enacting it as a consumer choice measure. And that's a relevant distinction in the WTO. Now, happily, the First Amendment...
Does the WTO draw any distinction between meat and apparel? In other words, I mean, there are there are compelled disclosures that apply to apparel, country of origin compelled disclosures that apply to apparel. And do those raise the same sorts of WTO issues? I'm asking because I just don't know.
Well, WTO proceedings, and if you look at the one in this case, it depends on a heavy analysis of the relevant market and the context of the regulation and so on. So I'm not here to tell you that it would be exactly the same in the context of any other product. The point that I was making is simply that what Congress was trying to do and what the agency was doing here is to allow consumers to make choices that they can make based on to have broaden the amount of information that's going to be available to consumers in making choices about the food that they eat. And that, as Zoudera pointed out, is the whole reason that there is protection for commercial speech in the first place is because of the information to consumers that such protection or the speech that results provides. So the only point that we're making here is simply that if the government were here trying to ban country of origin labeling or trying to ban, as the Supreme Court cases go, alcohol content or prices or whatever all of these restrictions were, then that would be quite a different matter. Here, it's the flip side. What the government is doing is providing more information. And now Zoudera recognized.
You recognize that not every consumer aspect of curiosity can be the justification for an information mandate, don't you or don't you? I mean, particularly, how do you handle AMI's hypothetical at page 20, note 4 of their brief, the requirement of disclosure of the nationality of the people picking crops?
Well, again, I mean, this goes back to the questions that were asked earlier about picking up on potentially, problematic, biases and other things. If that's what's going on, I mean, that could be problems with other parts of the Constitution, too. But I guess, and that could, as I mentioned.
This is an important hypothetical for me. How do you distinguish what Judge Williams just asked and what I asked earlier?
I'm sorry, can you?
Yeah, distinguish made in the USA from made by U.S. citizens. If you can do that successfully, you'll go a long way to convincing me, but I'm not sure how you can do that.
Well, I mean, there are actual differences in the product itself if it's made in the United States.
Your point to other parts of the Constitution, isn't it a violation of the Constitution to discriminate on basis of national origin among people already in the United States? So wouldn't this be giving rise to a bias that the Constitution otherwise forbids, if that's the actual implication here? Isn't it one thing to talk about, what country something is made in, which is not otherwise unconstitutional, and otherwise for the government to give a message, which strikes me as not uncontroversial, that you should make determinations based on national origin, which would violate due process clause and equal protection?
Yeah, that's what I was getting at.
You need to say it more expressly.
You're of course right, Your Honor. The other points that I wanted to add is simply relate to we're distinguishing among the products themselves as opposed to distinguishing among, based on biases of the people who made the products. And the other one ties into
I don't think, correct, because you're distinguishing American ranchers growing the cattle from Canadian and Mexican ranchers growing the cattle and hogs, right? And the implicit message is that consumers might think American ranchers who grow cattle and raise cattle and hogs are better in terms of safety and therefore the consumer might prefer that. I think that's been your argument, isn't it? I mean, you don't want to say that, I guess, but that's implicit in what you're saying, is American ranchers are better at safety, better at complying with things American consumers care about than are Mexican and Canadian ranchers. No?
I think just to be clear about what the differences are, it's not simply the differences in who the people are, which is the point that Chief Judge Garland was getting at. When things in America, are subject to American regulatory schemes or American practices, and they may differ from the practices for any number of reasons.
You haven't asserted a safety interest. That's what I don't I'm having trouble squaring the circle when there's no safety interest asserted, health interest asserted.
Well, this is the problem. This is the delicate point.
And you can't assert that having read the amicus briefs of Canada and Mexico.
Well, this is the point that I was getting to earlier about the distinction between the government itself saying we think it's safer, better, whatever, and our asserted interest is we think Americans should prefer American meat. That is not what we're saying. Versus consumers can make their choices, and some consumers may, people might have, people have interests about the food that they eat in particular, about where it comes from, about the circumstances in which it's raised, about any number of attributes of it. And the government doesn't have to say, everybody should buy locally grown meat or locally grown anything else, or it should be raised under certain condition, or it should be. I mean, the government doesn't have to come out and endorse those propositions in order to decide that it has a legitimate interest in allowing consumers.
Well, and the government may not be in a position to do that, but isn't it facilitating consumers and journalists and businesses and competing businesses saying, look, actually, the grass-fed beef from Mexico is so much better than the grain-fed beef from Canada or the United States, or the environmental practices are better in Canada, or the labor practices are better in the United States. I mean, it's facilitating any number of investigations, assertions, improvements, in fact, under our free trade regime to just know the information. And, I mean, it's giving you information that's equal about Mexico and Canada and the United States, and people are talking about protectionism, but it's not entirely obvious, even having read all the briefs, why this is necessarily a protectionist interest if that debate becomes robust once the information is provided.
Right, and the point that we're making here is simply that this is providing more information. And
it's relevant
and
information.
It's relevant information, it is pointing to real distinctions. There are conceitedly, even though they might be, people might perceive them as equally safe, there are conceitedly different practices in different places, and the origin of...
So
can you address...
the government always construed Zouderer as it does now?
I'm not sure exactly what I'm being asked.
My question is, has the government ever taken the position that Zouderer means something different than what you're arguing now?
I'm not aware of a circumstance in which the government has said that Zouderer is limited to cases in which the government is combating deception. Since the principal argument we're making here is that it is not limited to such circumstances, to my knowledge, I don't know, I'm not aware of every single brief the government has ever filed, to my knowledge.
I think it was the United States opposition to the motion for a preliminary injunction below. You're not familiar with?
I mean, I've reviewed the...
That brief? Okay. What it says is, in order for Zouderer to apply to a commercial speech regulation, the regulation must be aimed at correcting misleading speech and preventing deception of consumers.
And
now, that's very different from what you're arguing here. So what precipitated the change?
Well, I suspect, and based on my recollection, that the citation that followed the passage that Your Honor just recited was to this Court's decision in Reynolds, and obviously Reynolds, as was discussed by the panel and has been discussed in the brief, made some statements that suggested that the government's interest, had to be in combating deception. And we urged in the district court, and we've urged again in this court, that there are actually anti-deception rationales, particularly for the changes from the statute to the rule in this case.
Well, I think, oddly enough, you were quoting Milovic's in that language. And you now take a different position on what Milovic means.
Your Honor, what we argued in the district court, and we have not abandoned this argument, is that there is, in addition to other rationales, an anti-deception rationale at play here. The district court cited, and we have cited again in our briefs in this court, evidence that the old regime, and of course what's at issue here is the change from a rule that had one set of requirements on manufacturers or on retailers to a different set, and the issue, and what we have cited both in both courts is evidence that consumers weren't getting accurate information or complete information.
So can you tell me what would the rule be now? In other words, what's the rule that the government would have us impose? It's a new version, it seems to me, of Zouderer. And so if it doesn't fit into the central Hudson hierarchy, what is it? Are you actually arguing that it's rational basis now, this new standard that we would be developing?
I'm not sure I would say it's a new standard. I mean, Zouderer has been described by a number of courts as similar to rational basis, at least in circumstances where you're not actually chilling someone's speech. But the question that the en banc court posed to the parties was whether Zouderer itself is limited to circumstances where the interest asserted is combating deception, or whether it applies when there are other interests asserted. And our position, based on our reading of Zouderer, which talks at considerable length about the differences between disclosures on the one hand and restrictions on the other hand, and has only a few mentions of the fact that the interest that was asserted in that case happened to be an interest in deception, our position is that the rationale of Zouderer is applicable even if the government interest asserted is something else. I'd like to just mention, because opposing counsel said something about the Riley case also. Now, in Riley, the concern was the same concern we're talking about here, although it was in the context of non-commercial speech. The concern was that the particular disclosures that were being compelled would chill the protected speech. In that circumstance, the claim was that if you had to make all these disclosures about exactly where you were getting your funding or how you were spending it and so on, then you wouldn't be able to do the solicitation. And since the solicitation was seen as a First Amendment good, in fact, not even just commercial speech, but akin to core speech, that was the problem in Riley. It didn't say, and it didn't overrule Zouderer's conclusion that factual disclosures in the commercial context are not
On Zouderer, I had one more follow-up line of questions, which is determining whether it's not controversial. How do we do that?
This case, unfortunately, doesn't present a great vehicle to lay out a standard for that because it hasn't been disputed among the parties in this case.
We're going to write an opinion that's, I think it is disputed, first of all, but anyway, we're going to have to write an opinion saying, here's how you determine that this is not controversial. And what do you want us to say?
Well, I don't think that it's true that an opinion needs to say, here's how you determine. The panel opinion.
Okay, here's why we determine that this is not controversial.
Well, but
what do you want us to say?
Well, in this case, they haven't argued in their briefing that it is controversial. So you could start with that. But in terms of determining it, this is factual information, and in order to demonstrate that something is controversial or is non-factual and controversial, you would need to have some showing of what it was about it that made it controversial.
Exactly. This, how do we do that? This is, you know, we can't articulate what you just articulated in an opinion, I don't think. What do we look at? Do we look at what controversial from the perspective of consumers, how many consumers, that some people's behavior would be changed or not, well, that people object or not, that it strikes us as not consistent with our own sensibilities about what's good and proper in America?
Well, I think what Your Honor has identified is a problem with doing this in the abstract, where the issue wasn't joined between the parties. But just, we know some things, some limitations, because we know that the fact that it will make consumers, you know, less likely to purchase the product alone can't be enough, because many disclosures are of that nature, including the one in Zouderer itself. We have some data points. We have Milovich's discussion of debt relief agency that was argued to be confusing, argued to give perceptions about the bankruptcy attorneys at issue there that weren't accurate. That wasn't held to be non-factual and controversial. And this falls, I think, pretty comfortably. This is a circumstance where it's undoubtedly factual. There's no dispute the context.
I'm with you on that. I'm worried about the controversial. And I guess related to the question I'm asking, how can we not look at the implicit message, not just the explicit words? Or are you saying we can look at the implicit message, but that's okay here?
I'm not sure exactly what you mean by the implicit message.
The implicit message is to buy American.
I mean, I think, just to give another example, in the calorie count case from the Second Circuit, of course, there was an argument in that case about whether that was controversial because they said, you know, we don't think the calorie information is important as other information. It's going to bias you against this and that, and there's a debate, and that was easily found to satisfy the standard. So,
let me just focus on the same question that we asked Ms. Stetson. Is the uncontroversiality a question about the actual term of the disclosure, or is it in context? And I guess I would wonder how it could be in context, because isn't it the case that consumers and the government have the strongest interest in mandating disclosure where there are controversies about which people need to be informed? And, I mean, one way, I think, to understand the factual and uncontroversial is that uncontroversial is sort of a stand-in for viewpoint discrimination, which wherever it occurs would have to pop it back out of any kind of deferential review. Is that not consistent with how you see it? I realize that's a compound and multiple questions.
I think my understanding is similar to what you're saying. I think to say that something is controversial in the sense that, you know, the manufacturers would prefer that you not, you know, that this information not be relevant to consumers can't be enough. If you take something, I mean, and I'm not sure that factual and uncontroversial are sort of two separate elements that can be completely divorced from each other. If you take sort of...
Well, that's how the Supreme Court articulated them.
Well, they said purely factual and uncontroversial. Yeah. They didn't say, you know, and on the factual prong, da-da-da, and then on the uncontroversial prong, something else.
I think Judge Pillard raises a good question about the viewpoint discrimination. The question then is by American a viewpoint? Or maybe the viewpoint only goes with the words.
I don't think there's something in the nature of the disclosure that conveys that. I think if you could take a bunch of facts, if the facts were technically true, but, you know, sort of slanted in some way that it gave a misleading impression, which this certainly doesn't, that, you know, that might be, I'm not sure that that would, I'm hesitant to talk about hypotheticals because obviously in a case where the issue
was. That's what our argument's all about.
Right. Well, at least to bring it up on my own hand. But I mean, the problem is that this case is, the facts that are being presented here are really not conveying a message of that sort. Now, they may be motivated by, you know, they may be.
What is the message they are conveying in the government's view?
They're just conveying information. I mean, that's the thing. No.
So you've taken a position that it's just more information. And I also take you to be saying that, although I know some of the Court of Appeals cases disagree, that factual and uncontroversial are additional requirements of Zouderer and not unduly burdensome. Is there anything else that you think limits the position that you're taking? And am I right in pointing to those three things as limits?
I think that, I mean, what we're asking the court to do in this case is to say that when you have factual and uncontroversial information that's being provided in the commercial speech context, and then that Zouderer is applicable. And then in terms of the burden, we think that the relevant measure of the burden relates to the burden on protected First Amendment interests rather than the burden on commercial interests.
Could I put a couple of hypotheticals to you? The first is, suppose there's a mandate that meat importers from Canada put on the label, beef importers to make it specific, there has been a case of mad cow disease in Canada in the past, period, full stop, which I believe to be true. Is that okay?
I don't think that would be problematic if the importer, of course, wanted to, you know, put that in context and was prohibited from doing so. That could be problematic. Obviously, that case.
So your exception for misleading by implication doesn't reach my hypothetical. I thought my hypo was easy.
I think you might need more facts in terms of what exactly that was, what that was getting at, and the impression that.
So I take it then my second hypo was not a hypo, but the facts in Amestoy, and the government's position before the panel was that Amestoy was wrong, and that there was no problem at all about requiring the label. This product does not contain, or the animals were not fed RBST. So I take your position it's the same as before the panel.
Right. Well, we said another thing before the panel, which was that we also thought it was, you know, it was distant from this case because
yes,
at least
the panel picked up on that.
Right, and I appreciate that. I mean, this goes to the fact that the argument in those cases, or the argument in the hypotheticals that are being put, relates to circumstances where they say, although you purport to be giving a factual statement, what you're actually doing is something else. That is not what's going on in this case, and that's why. And that's why I was resisting the suggestion that an opinion in this case would have to resolve these issues, which might come up in other cases.
Even if that's not what's going on in this case, what is there to limit exactly that kind of labeling, given your argument for the scope of the government's right to compel this?
Well, I mean, there's a few answers. The first, as I mentioned earlier, is that the very regulation at issue in this case, in this very case, was challenged on the ground that it was arbitrary and capricious because it was too burdensome to comply as compared to the value to consumers. You know, they haven't renewed that argument. We don't think it's a winning argument in this case.
Well, that's, to be fair, they haven't renewed it because we didn't ask for en banc on that, and they did reserve it.
You know, the arbitrary and capricious challenge, they didn't even renew on appeal. They didn't say that the district court was wrong on that ground. The only arguments that they've made on appeal are the First Amendment argument we've been discussing today and an argument that it's inconsistent with the statute. There was a third argument in the district court, which was that it was arbitrary and capricious because of the weighing of the costs. Now, that would be a limiting principle if the government starts requiring extremely burdensome disclosures, and burdensome in the sense that there are a lot of work to comply with and can't justify it if an agency doesn't.
That's one of the arguments that they make here, is that this is an extremely burdensome disclosure. But I was more interested in, you know, counsel has said over and over again that what you're proposing here has no limits. And what I'm trying to find out is, what do you think limits it?
Well, in Zouder, what the Supreme Court thought limited it was the possibility that it would burden protected commercial speech. So if we had such a large, and the business card example was given, that's not a hypothetical, that's the Ibanez case from the Supreme Court, it's tantamount to a restriction on speech if you say, okay, well, you can say what you want to say, but in order to do it, you have to have this laundry list of disclosures that makes it impractical to say what you want to say, or even makes it undesirable to say, and then that might shift into a more Central Hudson-like inquiry. But
in your view, unless what the government is requiring is so extensive that it drowns out the producer or retailer's speech, it's perfectly okay for the government to require that.
Well, the phrase from Zouder is not drowns out, but chills. And so we're not saying that that is a completely toothless requirement. In the context of routine commercial disclosures of the type at this case and in the ones that were discussed earlier for other products, we think the likelihood that those are going to meaningfully affect an advertiser's ability to get out their message is quite minimal, and that those have rightly never been thought to pose constitutional problems, and we don't see a reason that
doesn't Zouder, in addition to talking about whether something is unduly burdensome, also say that it has to be justified? I mean, the problem I have with your argument is that you seem to just ignore that there's some requirement that there be a justification for the disclosure, and you're not articulating what that justification is, how we're to judge that, what is the standard that applies to the government justification. Are you saying that there, I mean, explain to me what is your view of the justification side of this from the government's obligation?
Well, just to be clear, the sentence we're talking about is the one that says unjustified and unduly burdensome disclosure requirements might offend the First Amendment by chilling protected commercial speech.
Yes.
And so the question is, as I understand it, what the justification needs to be. Now, justification in most circumstances is going to be quite easy, but if you're providing information about the product that a consumer is considering purchasing, then that is likely to be the justification. Now, that's not a lot, but I don't think
that any justification that one could say with a straight face is good enough. That's the test.
I don't think that the justification I've just put to you is that far down on the list of acceptable.
I want to know what the test is, so that if we write an opinion, we can say what the test is. It's a straight face test. That's the test.
Again, I don't think that this case presents an opportunity to flesh out what a test would be, but I'm perfectly comfortable with saying that most of the time the government's interest is going to be the one that's at issue here, which is providing consumers with information about the products they're considering.
What if it's not about the product? Do you agree that that's a different test? What if it was some other requirement unrelated to the product, but the product has a nice billboard that the government wants to get its message across on? Watch out for strangers, or, you know.
Have you
seen This Lost Child, for example? Is that one that the government could compel a milk carton company to put on? Obviously, many milk companies do it voluntarily, but could the government compel that under the Zouderer test? Or would you agree that's something different?
I mean, that's quite a different case. That's distinct from Zouderer in a number of ways. And
so the answer is yes, this doesn't come within your Zouderer analysis.
It certainly doesn't come within the analysis we put forward in this case. What the arguments would be in that case, I can't speculate.
So a number of courts have talked about Zouderer's rationality review. Is your position at the threshold that the government's interest has to be merely rational? Does it have to be reasonable, legitimate, all of the above? Can it be post hoc? These are the questions when we're under a kind of rationality review type scenario, and I think we're just trying to figure out how you would have us articulate that.
Right. I mean, I think that in the normal routine case, as in this case, that so long as it's clear that the government's interest in providing information to consumers relevant to their purchasing decisions is reasonable and legitimate, and whatever else is required, then it's not clear to me that much more needs to be done to flesh that out.
Let's say we had a statute that had no legislative history and it just had a disclosure requirement, and we as judges thought, yeah, that sounds great. That's the kind of information that we think, in the exercise of our common sense, consumers would want. Could we sustain it on that ground alone?
Yes. I don't think legislative history is central to this.
Or purposes in the regulatory process.
Or purposes in the regulatory process.
Further questions?
One more. Did you say to Judge Brown earlier that the government is asserting an anti-deception interest still?
We've made that argument at the panel stage. We haven't emphasized it in the en banc because in en banc we were.
So is it still in the case or not in the case?
It's still in the case. The question we were asked.
I take that. What is the anti-deception interest? What is the deception that this disclosure corrects?
Well, the issue related to the content of the disclosure, and there were previous disclosures that were problematic because they indicated something that was was not accurate as to the particular meat that was at issue. There was the commingling practice, which was a previous agency regulation authorized. If more than one animal was processed on the same production day, they could all be labeled with the same label, even if particular animals, that label wouldn't be correct for that animal. And there was another change. So those are the concerns that would be driving the deception rationale as to the new regulation.
Can I ask you about one more possible label? Could the government require a label that says beef production increases greenhouse gases?
I apologize for my scientific uncertainty. If you take it that is a factual statement and uncontroversial, which is a question that I'm not here to answer, I suspect that the government could require something along those lines.
You think that's Zouder, or do you think that's under Central Hudson?
Well, again, you would have to.
Well, you said you didn't think it was necessarily uncontroversial, so that sounds from your previous discussion that that would have to go under some other test.
But I said the question of whether it's uncontroversial relates to science that I'm not going to opine on from the podium. But the other question in such a case, and this would be within the Zouder framework, would be how that interferes with what the manufacturer's, you know, speech that they want to engage in. And so it's just a difficult one to answer in isolation like this.
Okay, no further questions. I'm sure there's no time left, but we'll give you an extra 5 minutes since nobody seems to be paying attention to the clock anyway.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate it. You all asked Mr. Tenney what the government's interest was, and what you heard was that the government has an interest in furthering consumers' ability to act on consumer preferences. We have actually a mechanism to enable consumers to act on their preferences. It's called the market. And here, the government is purporting to arrogate to itself the authority to compel speech that the market actually hasn't shown that is valued at all.
Isn't that true of virtually all these disclosure requirements? I mean, the long list going back to 1890, if consumers in 1890 cared enough about the place of origin, they could boycott goods that did not have disclosures. But for 125 years, Congress has thought that wasn't enough, and the courts have not had any trouble with that basic principle.
No, but I think what we're talking about here, Judge Williams, is the idea that mere consumer interest could be enough. And as we've already discussed, there are other interests animating many of those, both tariff-related, counterfeit-related, that are animating many of those other statutes. But here, the idea that it is enough for the government to say we have an interest in furthering consumers' interest in whether this particular meat has what the agency called latent attributes that may or may not be evident on the face of the package, that is not a substantial government interest. It's not even a legitimate government interest.
How does it compare with the interest involved in Fox, the Tupperware case?
The interest in Fox.
The interest in keeping Tupperware sales out of the college dorm superior in weight to the interest involved here?
Yes. I think the interest in Fox had to do with both maintaining the academic atmosphere of the college dorm, preventing strangers from coming into the college dormitory environment. There were several other interests that were in play.
Do you think the only problem with college dorms is that they have Tupperware parties? Your children must go to different college than mine.
It was a different time, Chief Judge Garland. But we also, we don't, one of the other points that Mr. Tenney made was that we haven't argued that this impinges on our other speech. We don't have to argue that this impinges on other speech. What we have to argue, and we have, is that we are being compelled to speak when we don't wish to. That is the nature of freedom of speech. So this idea that the government keeps trying to flip the tables and say, well, you haven't articulated much of an interest. It's really just kind of a minimal interest. You haven't explained what else you might be saying that is impinged upon. We don't have to. That's the point of the freedom of speech analysis. Judge Pillard, I think you asked Mr. Tenney what limits could exist on the government's theory, and at first you didn't get an answer. Judge Brown, you asked him the same question, and the answer he gave was there might be a point where limits on or disclosure restrictions could be unduly burdensome. This disclosure restriction, according to the government, costs $200 million. So there's a point. If there's a point beyond that where it becomes unduly burdensome, I'd love to know what that number is. Fourth and finally, Mr. Tenney said something.
Can I just be clear, was that associated strictly with the labeling or keeping records as well?
Also with the commingling ban, Judge Rogers, which of course is still very much present in this case. It was the capital and record keeping and segregation costs associated with the entirety of this particular.
So would it be any different if we just drop the labeling? If you drop the label, I take it to be Judge Rogers' point, this is really not costs of labeling, but of the internal recording of country of origin. It's not expressed, not due to the requirement of speaking about it, but just of retaining it and maybe reporting it to an agency.
Well, I think that's slicing the issue a little bit thin, Chief Judge Garland. The fact is that this particular labeling regime purported not just to require speech, but to require records, to require a ban on commingling, and all of the things that we've discussed, of course, in the statutory section.
Right,
of our
but group. Those last two things you said are not protected by the First Amendment. There's not a First Amendment, unless you're arguing one, which would lead to a lot of interesting hypotheticals, that requiring a company to keep records, you don't think that violates the First Amendment, or that barring a company from commingling meat, that doesn't violate the First Amendment.
No,
there's
but,
no labeling requirement attached
but
to
if
that.
The if the idea is that there is that the outer limit to this to the government's theory here, which is that disclosures on commercial speech, anything goes, is that this as long as the disclosure isn't unduly burdensome, this particular disclosure and everything that comes along with it is burdensome to the tune of $200 million, and that's the government's number. Let me make one last point.
If we agreed with you and we vacated the disclosure requirement, you would have the same costs, wouldn't you?
If we vacated the disclosure requirement?
Well, the only thing you don't have to do is put it on the label, but you have to do everything else. And as you, if we took your view that this actually limited commingling itself, separate from the labeling, all the other things, recording, all those things stood, your costs would be the same.
I think our costs would be the same, but we haven't. We've asked for the regulation to be vacated in toto, and of course, the regulation also purports many, many times to ban commingling.
But those are not on First Amendment grounds. The other parts of the regulation that you're
challenging. The other parts of the regulation that we've challenged are not on First Amendment grounds. Yes. Let me make one last point, and that is on rational basis. What you heard Mr. Tenney say is that this case is similar to rational basis review. And Mr. Tenney said he didn't need to explain whether it was really, you know, legitimate state interest, reasonable state interest, rational basis, that could all get kind of worked out in the wash. This is, if you accept the panel's ruling here, this is rational basis minus. And when you're talking about where speech is compelled, you have to apply some standard other than that there be any interest in the air. If you give Zouderer any teeth at all, one tooth we ask for, if you find that Zouderer applies only to deception, if you find that it applies to deception and consumer protection, if you find that it applies to deception, consumer protection, and health and safety, as I've said, under any of those standards, we prevail.
Can I ask one question?
Yes.
There was a discussion of whether you were maintaining that this was controversial. Are you maintaining that this is controversial under Zouderer?
I think the controversy speaks for itself, given the array of amici in this case, yes.
A Mexican origin or a Canadian origin or United States origin fact, that's controversial.
Yes. If there are no further
questions.
No
further questions. We thank the parties and we'll take the matter under submission.
Stand, please.